Brothers and sisters, we are ready to begin our first class. Our speaker is Brother Jim Stiles. The theme for Brother Stiles' class this week is Ezra, Working Together in God's Service. Today's class is entitled, God Will Provide the Motivation to Finish.
Thanks, Jimmy. You can come and do the announcements in our ecclesia anytime you want. We always found with announcements, the funnier they were and the more you remembered them, which is really what you're after. Well, good morning, everyone. All right. Let's see if then looks like most people showed up. That's good. Hey, we're on to Thursday and people are still coming. All right. We left off yesterday, though, sort of in a negative way, that over the course of 15, 16 years, the interest in building that temple, it really went downhill. And in the end, God gave the people what they really wanted, sort of like when he gave them a king, when he gave them Saul. He gave folks what they really wanted, and what they wanted to do was stop and go back and build their own houses, panel their homes and fix themselves up, take a second job and get a little extra money and get some toys and get all the stuff of this world that they wanted. And that's what was happening over the course of time. And slowly the interest just like waned away to where people didn't really want to work. And so the angels, which by the way, maybe if it's everyone in the universe in that basketball team, see, maybe the angels would be involved as well. See, on the other side. Yeah. So those angels that were orchestrating the political events at that time, they just totally turned it all around instantly. And they had some fella show up who was an imposter, and he eliminated the king in this case, who was Cambyses. That would be Cyrus's son. He takes over the kingdom. And he's scared stiff about everything and worried about losing control of the kingdom. And what happens is that immediately when he gets this letter, he sends the army and stops the work. Now, we also know that politically in history, what happened at that time in the Persian Empire is a lot of the nations on the outskirts of the Persian Empire rebelled. They started realizing, wow, this guy's not in control. And they got some time, and that's what was happening. So you're going to see in Zechariah's prophecy, when Zechariah stirs up the people, the very first thing he sees is a vision of the angels coming back on horses, and they ride in and report to another angel and say, hey, we did our job. We brought the kingdom back under control. You know, how long are you going to wait until you prosper Jerusalem and get this work going again? These were angels that felt that way. And this is what Zechariah brings back to the people. So that's where we're at right now in terms of, like, you know, exactly in the history. If you want to look at where we're at in on the little time chart right there. So this fellow, the pseudo imposter guy that came in, he comes at the end of Cambyses, kills him, takes over only for a few months. It lasted. And then what God does is he totally changes the political climate. He has this fella killed. And the Persian leaders got together and decided Darius Hystaspes should be the king, and he now takes over the kingdom. And that's how quickly God can totally change the events politically. And you've seen some of that in our lifetimes. We've watched things just politically just switch. Look how fast the pandemic came through the world. What, 1 year? Only took a few months. Starts out one area of the world, and it was just scattered over the whole world in just a few months, and it affects everybody. This is what the angels can do. So the period we're going to be looking at today is from when the temple work stopped right in here until it got back going again here in the second year of Darius right there. And then it was finally finished in the sixth year of Darius. So it's like a 4 or 5 year window in there of where all these events are actually happening right now in terms of today's study. So chapter 5 of Ezra. The prophet Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophets prophesied to the Jews who were in Jerusalem and Judah in the name of the God of Israel. So you keep hearing this, the God of Israel, because it's a warning and an indicator to us that there were Gentiles who were getting involved in the community. Who was over them? So Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jozadak, they rose up and began to build the house of God, which is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, helping them. So some of the brethren and sisters realized that when the political climate changed and this pseudo-imposter was removed and a new king is put in, they went around and encouraged each other and said, this is it. This is the time. God's giving us a window of opportunity to get working on this temple again. And some of them got started, but they couldn't convince very many to jump on board. And so what God does, brethren and sisters, in ecclesial life and in our families, is that we do our part. We do our part. We have to be involved. But we pray that the Lord of the harvest will send out laborers into the harvest. And it's true in ecclesial life, not just for preaching, but in all aspects of ecclesial life. We pray that God will bring the right people into our ecclesia. He'll bring the right folks to involve our children, our grandchildren, so that they will be stimulated and their spirits will be stirred up to be involved in the work of God. And that's something we have to ask God to do, because we cannot do it ourselves. We can't. I mean, some of us are like really go-getters, and we think we can do these projects and going to get out there and change the world. And I remember taking teaching classes years ago, and that's what they would try to convince us, that we were going to go out there and change the world, right? And we understand you cannot do that without God on your side. And you learn to trust in the angels and pray for their help, because they can make things happen. So God used Haggai and Zechariah. He raises up two prophets in a time in which there weren't a lot of spirit gifts around. There's no evidence of that. And you know, this is just two fellows that show up, and they stimulate the people to get back to work. So in a sense, it really is similar to our day and age. They really didn't have a lot of prophets going around at this time, just Haggai and Zechariah. They didn't have spirit gifts, but they listened to these prophets, and it did work. It stimulated the people to get back to work, and they got the job done in 4 years. 4 years, and it's finally finished. They'd already put in 16 years into this project, and in 4 years, they're done. But what they had to see is the angels working behind the scenes. God was in there. He was doing it. He was doing his part, and he promised that he would fulfill his side of it. And he did. He took care of it, and in only 4 more years, it was done. And it's one of those things that all of us have to get on board with, that you see with the eye of faith, that we're not the only ones on these projects, that we've got God on our side. Jesus Christ is involved. He's sending his angels out to help us in the job of raising our children, of preaching the truth, of working in our ecclesias. It's all God's family. It's his. He cares about it. And he's the one who will help get the work done and stimulate the people to come and do it. So the coordinated efforts of Haggai and Zechariah really did affect the people at this time, and they got back to work. So the two prophets, it's interesting how you start looking at, well, why two? What was God doing right here? If you've ever studied Zechariah and Haggai, you see this, there's a whole different sense between these two prophets. They have a whole different approach. A lot of people think that Haggai was probably an older fella, and he comes in and he exhorts and he reprimands the group, and he says, look, guys, consider, you know, the last few years while you just like gave up on God's project and you went back and worked on your own homes and you got your fields going and you thought you're going to make a lot of money and do all this stuff. Did you notice how God put holes in your pockets and it all fell through? Did you notice that inflation went up and all that money you were making just wasn't worth it anymore? You know, taking on all these extra jobs so you could have all these toys. And it's like, didn't you notice? Consider how you fared. It really didn't work the way you thought it was going to. You've got to get back to working in God's family. Get back to working on the projects that God cares about. And that's what Haggai does. He says, you've made some bad choices, but it's not too late. Just go home and turn it around and get back involved. And Zechariah, who a lot of folks figure was a younger fella, he comes in and he sees in one night, he sees these night visions of how the angels care more about this project than you do. So forget about the day of small things. This isn't a day of small things to them. Oh no, because they care about the process. They know that this is what's going to grow the family of God. They're out there working with all these people in their lives, and they're hoping to develop them into children of God. And this project can do it. This can help. And the long-term benefit of having the temple finished and a place of worship for the community, they saw what was coming. And they realized this is important. We've got to get this done. And that's what Zechariah sees. I don't know whether you've ever noticed, but if you ever want to study the angels, start with Zechariah. There is more about angels in Zechariah's prophecies in the beginning of Zechariah than you're going to find in any other book. the interaction between the angels, the divine council, as it's called in the Psalms, of how they operated and how one angel works with other angels, sends them out. They come back and they report. And the other angel looks up to God and says, how long are you going to wait? We did our job. When can we get this done? And that's what happens in Zechariah. So over the 15 years or so that they've been working on the temple, what you find out from Haggai 1 is that some of the people came along and they said, you know, I'm sure it was probably some of those who were discouraged by this temple in the first place when they looked at it and said the foundation just, it's not as big as it was before, not as glorious. And so they claim, well, it's not the right time. You're going to see that Haggai 1 at verse 2, because their argument was it's not the end of the 70 years. According to our understanding of Bible prophecy, it's not the right time. That's what happened. So they went home and worked on their own houses. Isn't that what builders do? You've been working on the temple. You've been doing all this work. You learned a few things about how to fix stuff and build things. And so you go home and you apply to your house and let's put a new addition on the house. You know, let's remodel the kitchen. Let's do something. We'll fix the bathroom. And they went home and they paneled their own homes. And they tried to improve their own economic situation, probably did extra work, took another job, and they thought they were going to get ahead. And that's what happens to all of us. We go home from this Bible school thinking that we just want to get more stuff of this world. That's what we will do. We'll fix up our homes. We'll get other jobs so we can do that. And we'll advance ourselves in the corporate world to where we can get all the stuff of this world that we want. And Solomon says, I tried that, folks. Do you believe me? I tried it. I did a better job than any of you could ever do of that, because I had the money, the resources, the power, the wealth, the whole works. I tried it all. And if you believe me, you're just striving after wind. And some of us believe it and some of us don't. And we have to go through and experience that all over again. But he's left a record for us if we believe him. So that's what you'll see in Haggai chapter 1 if you read through this. We're in the second year of King Darius. This is the same Darius that we're talking about, Darius Hystaspes. In the sixth month, on the first day of the month, the word of the Lord comes to him. All right, and in verse 2, thus says the Lord of hosts, this people says that time has not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Can't you see how that happened when the Persian army came in and made them stop by force? That those who didn't want to build, they used that and said, well, see, there it is. There's the evidence. We should have quit. We shouldn't have been doing this all along. See, we made a bunch of mistakes. And he comes in and says, no, you're saying that, but that's not right. And then verse 4, is it a time for yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses and this temple to lie in ruins? So now, thus says the Lord, consider your ways, or as the RSV has and some of the other versions, consider how you have fared. Just look, think about it. Examine your lives. Is this really working? Do you really think this is going to bring you happiness and you think this is going to advance you? You've sown much and bring in little because God blew it away. You eat, but do not have enough. You drink, but you are not filled with drink. You clothe yourselves, but no one is warm. And he who earns wages to put into a bag with holes. Because they were using this excuse that the time was wrong, and so they tried to improve their own lives. And that's what's going on at this time. So when you look back as to how this ever happened, remember those two prophecies in Jeremiah that we looked at about the 70 years? Jeremiah 25 and Jeremiah 29. Jeremiah 25 was in the early days of Jehoiakim's reign. This is when Daniel got taken captive. And God said, "For after 70 years, he'll punish Babylon after 70 years. And in Jeremiah 29, just four chapters later, in the early years of Zedekiah, this would be when Ezekiel was taken captive, God said, well, after 70 years, he'll bring the Jews back and give them a future with peace and with hope. And so when you look at this 70-year captivity, what was happening is that if you started the 70-year captivity back when Daniel was taken captive, then people realized by the first year of Cyrus, the 70 years were up. They were over. But other people in the community argued as trouble came in and as they got tired of working on the temple, they said, oh, no, we weren't supposed to start then. We were supposed to start the 70 years when Zedekiah got taken captive, which was 20 years later, and that's when the 70-year captivity was supposed to start. And so they said, hey, the prophecy shows it's the wrong time. Sort of like folks today who think, well, they've studied out Bible prophecy, and they think, well, this has to happen, and this has to happen, and this has to happen before Jesus can return. And it doesn't. because the angels can just do it overnight. And you can't just sit around and say that, well, the time is not right because we got to see these nations align and according to prophecy and we got it all worked out and it's just not the right time. And God doesn't want us to think that way. We have to get involved and realize this, as Jesus said, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. So be ready. Be ready. And I don't even know our lives as to how long we'll last. And, you know, something could happen next week. And to us, the kingdom has come. So it's a good warning. Don't sit around and wait for Jesus Christ to return and then wait for these events to happen and think that, oh, yeah, I'm going to see all this. It may not be the case. So God tried to talk to them through the experiences of their life. You ever thought of that, brethren and sisters? It's one of those arguments that you see in the book of Job, where the, you know, Job, he tries to, when the Elihu comes in, and Job's just frustrated so much. He wants to talk to God. I want to talk to God. These three friends have pushed him in a corner. He wants his day with God. And Elihu comes in and says, Job, did you notice God has been talking to you? It's just people don't listen. And what Elihu tries to point out is God talks to us through the experiences of our life. He brings things into our life to try to help us understand. We pray about things and our expectation is that something's going to happen and it's all of a sudden going to be revealed. Or maybe some of us want an angel to come and talk to us at some point. And Elihu says, no, God talks to people through life and he opens their eyes. And this is what God was doing. He talked to them through their experiences. He says, look, you should have realized I brought the drought. I brought the blight. I brought the mildew and the hail. And that's why you haven't been bringing in crops. I brought the cold. I brought inflation. I did those things. It wasn't just random chance of politics of the world or whatever. I've been trying to explain to you to get your lives together and get back to work. And so don't just leave Bible school this week thinking that God only talks to us through the Bible. That's one mechanism that angels use. We read his word and that's important. But he talks to us through the experiences of life. Some of you may have noticed that sometimes we all get blinders on and we study a Bible topic and we think we've got the answer. I know what it is and we're so sure we're right. And it may be something involving other people's lives or the lives of other people in our ecclesia. And it's them, it's not us, it's their lives that we're making a decision about something that someone has done. And we study these topics and we think we're so sure we've got it right. And so what the angels do is they bring that issue into your family and they try to help us understand what it's like to be on the other side. So that they can broaden our perspective to understand and be more merciful and gracious to people that are going through those troubles. That's their job. That's what angels do. Because most of us learn more by personal experience than we do by studying a topic. It's unfortunate, but that's the human spirit. I remember on my street when COVID first hit a year ago, went up and down the street, all our neighbors I talked to, you know, they were all like, oh, this is a conspiracy and all this is like all this stuff. It's fake news. And it's just like the flu. And we get all this talk like this, talking to our neighbors. And it's like, well, aren't you really reading the news? You know, I guess they had selective websites that they read. And then one by one, Sue and I noticed that, wow, they're wearing a mask. They've changed. You know, what happened? Well, my brother just died of COVID. He went through 3 months on a respirator and died. And all of a sudden, through life's experiences, people realize, oh, maybe I was wrong about that research. You talk to somebody else. Well, my parents just died of COVID. And finally, they got serious about it. But this is what angels do for us in so many topics in our ecclesial life. They bring these things into our families. Things like when we talk about divorce and remarriage, or you talk about all kinds of issues in marriage and these kind of things. We study topics and we're so sure we got it right. And then all of a sudden, God brings it into our families and realize, oh, I never saw that before. Didn't think of that. Maybe there are some reasons for that. And it's an eye opener where God's trying to help us through life's experiences. So we do have to consider how we fare. We do have to look back and realize that. And as Haggai lays out his case right there, he says, look it, consider what's been going on. Realize God's trying to teach you something. And the solution in chapter 1 at verse 9 is to get back to work in God's family. Get back into the ecclesia. Get back involved. That's what God's trying to get us to see. And he helps us understand that. I remember at one point, my dad, when we were living in Detroit for years ago, and my dad got a little frustrated with some things going on in ecclesial life, and he moved my whole family to Florida. And we stayed down there for 3.5 years in St. Petersburg. That was way back in those days when the St. Pete Ecclesia had like one older sister who could hardly move and her son and our family. That was it in the St. Pete Ecclesia at that time. And we stayed down there for 3.5 years. And then finally my dad realized as we were growing up, none of us took an interest in the truth. It was great down there. We could play sports every day. We had all kinds of activities we're involved in, got involved in school stuff. And he finally realized, wow, these kids need a CYC. And he moved us back to Detroit because he realized through life's experiences that it wasn't working. And every so often we have to do that with our own lives. We have to evaluate, how is it going? Consider how you fared and make decisions for the future of your family, so you can leave them an inheritance. So that's what happens in the experiences of Haggai. That's what he attempts to bring into this, that God does talk to us through life's experiences. He uses economics, jobs, health, family troubles, accidents and friends, and all these different things to cause us to meditate on how is it really going? What's really happening? Are we just experiencing Ecclesiastes all over again and we're striving after the wind? Is that really what we're doing? So God talks to us, but the question is, are we listening? So the angels did what seemed to be impossible to many people at that time. They just overthrew the political kingdom. They bring in a new king at that point, and God opens up a door to get back to work on the temple by bringing in Darius Hystaspes to the throne. And some of the Jews realized that this was their time. This is an opportunity. It's like some people in ecclesial life are looking for windows of what can we do? What can we try now? Some of us has learned through COVID that, using Zoom all this time, we're finding out now that we can actually use Zoom and technology to do a lot of things that we never thought about before. They see the window opening to like have seminars online and all kinds of things that we've never been done before, or help ecclesias that are in isolation. We have one ecclesia in California back home, the Santa Barbara Ecclesia, with a lot of older members. I think they're all mainly over 80, and one brother who's there to run the meeting every week. And so he's realized by zooming into our meeting that he can actually now not have to do something every week, and he can provide an opportunity for his ecclesia. So they set up a big screen in the front. They all come to meetings still, and they watch meetings from other ecclesias. That's what they'll do. These are things that we've never thought about before. But God has opened windows for us to use our technology in better ways than we ever imagined. And maybe that was part of the reason why this whole virus hit. It's possible. So in Zechariah's 7 night visions, if you've ever looked at them before, I'll tell you one thing to do in our community is be careful when you're reading our Christadelphian expositors, because what a lot of our expositors do with Zechariah's 7 night visions is they look at one of them, they say, well, this clearly has an historical bit part of it because they can tell that they're talking about building of the temple. And then there's this next vision about the carpenters, and that doesn't seem to fit at all. So that must be in the future. That's a future one. And then there's this next one. Well, that goes back to the historical. And then there's another one that goes to the future. And they go back and forth between these visions. This one's past. This one's future. And I remember looking at that for years ago and thinking, like, there's something wrong with that. And there's a great series of articles in the Testimony magazine back in like the 70s or something that Edward Whitaker wrote, looking at the historical basis for Zechariah's prophecies. And he went through all 7 of them and showed how they all had an historical basis back then. At this time, when they were trying to get the people motivated to build the temple. And it's good to understand the historical application because that gives you a basis for understanding what the real future application really means. So I would encourage you to, go back and search those things. You can probably find them somewhere online these days. So what Zechariah does is in one night he sees these visions and he comes back probably the next day. He says, wow, I can't wait to tell you what I saw. And he's probably all excited about trying to stir up the people. He said, the first vision, I saw this vision about angels on horses. They'd been out there bringing the empire back under control so that the right conditions can be there for us to finish this temple. And they came back and reported to another angel who's excited as well. And then in chapter 1 at verse 12, these angels, especially the one who's in charge, he finally asks God, he says, how long are you going to wait to have mercy on Jerusalem? And he's giving this response to the people and explaining that we can't see them, but the angels are excited about this project. They want to see it finished. Or in chapter 2, how if you read that section in chapter 2, how the guy goes out to measure Jerusalem, you know, and some of our expositors said they were measuring it for destruction. And I think they've got it totally wrong. I remember talking to Brother John Martin one day, and he says, no way, that's not destruction. The whole point of chapter 2 is that God will be a wall of fire. And he says, you don't need to go out with your measuring rod and measure the city. Forget about the walls. You know, because that's what was happening. Some people said, well, forget the temple. We should be building the walls and have protection because all these nations around us, they want to get us. And God gives them a message and says, forget about the walls. I'll be a wall of fire to you. I will protect you and save you and so on. And then there's that message in chapter 2 to those that were still up in Babylon. Get out of Babylon. Get out of there and come back down. And those that didn't come back down, they experienced this situation with Haman later on. Or in chapter 3, when Joshua stands before the angel, before the Lord, and the angel rebukes Satan. And then the angel says, Joshua, we're going to change your clothes. You've been working on this temple. Your clothes are dirty. You're all worn out because you're trying to get this work done. I promise you, we'll change your clothes. You're going to put on your high priestly garments and you will operate as high priest again. You, Joshua, not somewhere in the future, but you will be the one. And then in chapter 4, he says, look at Zechariah, Zechariah comes in, he says, all right, that's Joshua in chapter 3. He comes back and says to Zerubbabel, he says, I promise you, Zerubbabel, that you will see the capstone go up to the temple. You're going to see it finished and you will be alive. So Joshua and Zerubbabel are going to both be there when this is finished. And by the way, the stone in chapter 4, when you ever study Zechariah, don't get lost on this idea of the seven eyes on the stone. A lot of people think the seven eyes were on the stone, but what the seven eyes are doing is they are looking at the stone. The seven eyes are the angel of God, and they're watching the capstone over on the side, the last stone that's going to go in, and they just can't wait for the day when the capstone goes up and the whole temple is finished with shouts of grace, grace, grace to it. Because it was all by the grace of God. And that's what they're waiting to see. And the message of chapter 4 is, you guys may despise the day of small things, but do you realize the angels are excited? You know, their eyes are on that capstone, and they can't wait. They rejoice to see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. And we don't think of that sometimes, brothers and sisters. But imagine if you were an angel today. What's it going to be like for you in the kingdom when you're working with people? You know, aren't you going to get excited about the work? Don't you think it's thrilling to see, you know, people make progress over time? You're working with somebody and you see their spiritual development, or you realize there's this project you want to get accomplished because you know it's going to help for years down the line in developing God's family. These angels get excited about it, maybe more than we do, and they can't wait to see these things finished. And we don't want to let them down. Look at how hard they work for us every day, all the time, trying to get us into God's family. They're active. Don't let them down. So what happens in chapter 5 then is that Tatnai, the governor of the region beyond the Jordan, beyond the river, and Shethar-Baznai and their companions, they come to them and spoke to them, and they say, all right, guys, who commanded you to build this temple and finish this wall? And so we gave them the names. They wrote them down and said, well, here they are. Here's the list of names of people who are involved in this. But the eye of their God, see, this is the eyes of the Lord in this case, was on the elders of the Jews. The angels were there involved as well, and they could not make them cease till a report should go to Darius. And then a written answer was returned concerning this matter. So God's involved in this. And the work only stopped for about 2 years. That's all. Maybe a year and a half even. We're not even totally sure. But this group of people, they don't seem to be as nasty as the Samaritans were. They're not introduced as the adversaries like that. These people are just trying to figure out, are you really supposed to be doing this? It's been like 15, 16 years now that's going on. And now you're getting back to work again. And now we got a new king involved and they're challenging whether this should actually be done. But God's willing to work with this and help these people. So the eye of their God was upon them. Even though they couldn't see it visibly, they had a couple of prophets helping them. But look at how in the scriptures, the eye of God is used so often of the angels. Back in 2 Chronicles 16, Hanani, he says to Asa that the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him. This is when he's chewing out Asa for the fact that, Asa, you shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have hired the Syrians to come down and fight with the northern kingdom so that they would, you know, stop building the cities down in the south like that. Or in Zechariah 3, we've got the eyes of God. The seven eyes are on that stone. They're watching that capstone, waiting for the day when that final stone will go up. See, that stone in Zechariah 4, that's not the cornerstone. That was laid years ago. This is the capstone that the builders, when they built back then, they would say, this is going to be the best final stone, and they would set it aside. And then when the stones came from the quarry and better ones came along, they might switch it up. But they constantly saved that last stone that was going to go up there and hold the building in place. Because the angels at this point were excited, and they promised to get it done. And even in the New Testament, in Peter, you can see that the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous. So they get an answer, all right? The answer, this letter goes up to the king, and look at how Darius responds. You know, they write this letter, say, we're building, we're servants. This is the response, sorry, that they gave to in chapter 5 at verses 11. This is from the Jews. We're servants of the God of heaven and earth, and we're rebuilding the temple that was built many years ago. But look at verse 12. Because our fathers provoked the God of heaven to wrath, he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. So they admit, they're honest about this and say that, look, at the reason we had to go through this wasn't because of Bel conquering us. It's because we blew it. We messed up and we weren't faithful to our God. And so God sent us up to Babylon. But then God sent through Cyrus a decree to build this house. And the challenge is out there then that, look at, you know, we're going to try to get this done because it was by the decree of Cyrus. So it's good to see these people responding in faith right now. And they continue the work. They don't stop this time. They continue working. And they're waiting for response from the king in the end. And the unbelievers notice the commitment. If you look back in verse 8, they noticed how committed these people were. And again, it was a witnessing project. Some of these Gentiles are slowly creeping in to the community. And so later on in Zechariah's prophecies, when you see the evidence of how God's prediction is, and in latter days, that all the things he does in the nation of Israel are going to bring Gentiles in from the sides. In a sense, it was happening even back here. Some Gentiles were being converted. And so these people, they did faithfully witness to God, and they did accept the blame. And now they're looking to Cyrus's decree. And wow, isn't it good that chapter 1 said that the decree was also written down, because they had to go back and find it. And when you get to this chapter, you can see there really is a bunch of evidence that Sheshbazzar, as he was called, is actually what we would call Zerubbabel. He probably had a Persian name, and he also had a Hebrew name. And he's probably the same fella. You can see that he's the governor in Ezra 5 and also in Haggai 1. And he laid the foundation of the temple in Ezra 5, but it's Zerubbabel in Zechariah 4. So it's probably true that Sheshbazzar is actually just a different name for Zerubbabel. So what do they do? All right. They're at, what they asked the king to do at the end of chapter 4 and verse 17 is, let a search be made in the king's treasure house, which is in Babylon, as to whether or not Cyrus really made this decree. And I'm sure they're praying and hoping that somewhere somebody's going to find Cyrus's decree. And the good news is in chapter 6 that that's exactly what they did. King Darius had a search. Did Cyrus make that decree? It's like 16 years has gone by, and all the political stuff that's gone on, and, you know, all the different things that happen, and who knows how much stuff that when the usurper took the throne, a lot of times what they would do is right away destroy records so that you couldn't, look back and claim this guy was a usurper. But they searched around, and what did they find in verse 2 of chapter 6 at Akmetha, all right, in the palace that was in the province of Media? A scroll was found, and in it a record was written, Cyrus's decree. And the record that they, when they finally read it, they realized that, wow, this is even more than you could even ask for. You know, and it's like, let the expenses be paid from the king's treasury. You see that? See, that's not what was initially happening, but now it's let the expenses be paid from the king's treasury. They found the record. They found what this record said, and it was more than they could ever ask or think. So if you're ever looking for this Akmetha place or whatever, it's currently called Ecbatana now, and it's up there. It was a summer residence for the Persian kings up in the higher areas where it wasn't so hot. And so that's where they find the scroll. And again, you can see how the angels made sure that a copy was kept. It was up there, and they made sure that the search went that far, that they got up there and searched the summer palaces up there, and they find a copy of the scroll. And wow, it's just unbelievable what can happen. Yeah, it is true there are some differences between Ezra 1 and Ezra 6. Some of you may want to look at that at some point, but I want to keep moving today. So we get into chapter 6 at verse 6. So now here's what ends up happening. All right, therefore, in verse 6, Tattenai, governor of the region beyond the river, and Shethar-Bozenai, and your companions, the Persians who are beyond the river, here's the response of Darius Hystaspes. He tells them, keep yourselves far from there. Let the work on this house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build this house of God on its site. And verse 8, look at this. Imagine if you were a Jew listening to this letter and you hear what God has done for you. Moreover, I issue a decree that what you shall do for the elders of the Jews for the building of the house of this God, let the cost be paid at the king's expense from the taxes. Get this, from the taxes on the region beyond the river. Now, this is the region beyond the river from the perspective of the capital of Persia. Beyond the river would be all these other nations on the other side of the Euphrates, many of whom are the ones who were challenging the work of the building of the temple. In the end, he says, you guys leave them alone, and you know what? Your taxes are going to pay to get this thing finished. Imagine listening to this as a Jew and finding out this is what God has done for you. And this is to be given immediately to these men so that they are not hindered. And whatever they need, young bulls, rams, and lambs for the burnt offerings of the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine, oil, according to the request of the priests who are in Jerusalem, let it be given them day by day without fail, that they may offer sacrifices of sweet aroma to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. And this is more typical of what the Persians would do. They wanted everybody to pray for their kingdom. But if you had been alive back then, imagine listening to this letter and just thinking, wow, we didn't even ask for that. God did more than we could even ask for. And that's how excited God was about this project. And the angels as well. They want to make sure this gets done. And so that is really awesome to see what angels can accomplish behind the scenes. When we trust God in faith, we're working in God's family, involved in his projects, trusting him to work in our families and ecclesias. We've got to do our part, brothers and sisters, but God does the impossible. He's the one that opens the eyes of their understanding. He's the one that calls these people, and he does things that we just cannot do as parents, grandparents, ecclesial members. And he can do the impossible for our ecclesias as well. Far more abundantly, as the RSV says, than we ask or think. So the work got going, and that's what they did at the end of chapter 6. The elders of the Jews, they built, they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai and Zechariah, and Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. They built and they finished it, according to the command of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, king of Persia, which we will look at tomorrow as to what that phrase actually means. And the temple was actually finished on the third day of the month of Adar, which is in the sixth year of the reign of Darius. So it's done. 4 years now, and they're done. That's all it took at this point because of what God had done for them. I imagine back then when they got started, they probably thought they were in for another 15, 16 years. But now with all this help and the taxes from the king's treasury and whatever they needed, they got. It got done fast. And they celebrated in verse 16 the dedication of the house of God with joy. And they offered sacrifices at the dedication of the house of God. You don't hear any more about, you know, some people being excited and other people crying. It's like they're finally excited about this project when they realize that God was in it. It was God's project. And that's the way they should have looked at it all along. And again, you've got, you know, they're trying to follow the directions in verse 18 of the directions that were in the law of the book of Moses. So they went back there and they tried to keep what Moses had written for the priests. So the temple does get finished, right? The king asked that they'll pray for him and his sons, but that was pretty typical of what Persians did. In the 12th month of Adar right now, they're ready for the first month of the new year for Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And in the end, the whole time for the building of the temple was really about 20 years in the end. This is that 20-year period between the first, the captivity and the final captivity. The 20 years the people argued about where the time was not right. And they celebrated with joy. And they had to have in the back of their mind thinking that Zechariah had warned us that don't despise the day of small things. So it isn't as good as the other one was. It's not as fantastic or whatever. It's not the building that God cares about. It's what can happen in the building. It's the development of his people that he cares about, not the actual building. And sometimes that's hard for us to keep in mind. So never despise the work of God. Never discourage people when they go out to do things today in ecclesial life, no matter how small the project. Encourage people that we don't know what God is going to do. We really don't. We cast our bread out there on the waters and we're not really sure which things he's going to prosper. And the more people that are doing it, the better. That's really good. So when it happens in ecclesial life or in your families, when there is success, when you're raising your children and you finally find out one day, wow, they got it. They really care. They want to get baptized. They want to be involved in the ecclesia. They want to give their lives over to Jesus Christ. Don't forget, all the success is of God. Sure, we do our part as parents. We do what we're supposed to do. We do the Bible readings. We get them out to CYC. We teach in Sunday school. We do all those things. But there are a lot of other people, brethren and sisters, who do those things and their children don't love the truth. We got to remember that because it's God's family. It's God's election, not ours. And when there is success and when God blesses our efforts of witnessing, raising children, whatever it is in ecclesial life, don't ever forget it's not because of what I did. It's because of what God does. It's his election. He opens the eyes of our understanding. See, we could teach the truth to our children until we're blue in the face and they may never get it. They may never get it. Some of you may not remember, but when they revised our BASF years ago and they put in clause 24, remember what the brethren put in back there? Who are the responsible? Think about it. Do you remember what that phrase says? It's right in our statement of faith. Who are the responsible? Those who know the revealed will of God. Right? Got to know. And what's after the and? See, and God has called them, called upon to submit to it. That's why in John's gospel, you'll keep hearing Jesus constantly say, you didn't do it. You didn't find me. I found you. And it's all over John's gospel so that we don't miss the point. It's not about our efforts. It's not about how hard we run. Paul covers this in Romans 9. It's not about what we want. It's God's family and it's all about God's mercy. And we've got to come to understand that as a group. We need to as parents, as grandparents, as ecclesial leaders, as people who go out and witness. We don't have to beat up people with the truth and argue with them until we've like destroyed them because we proved all our first principles. We go home and pray that God will open the eyes of their understanding, as Paul says in Ephesians. That's what we really want, that God will do the impossible. And when it happens, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, therefore, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord, our labor is not in vain. It's not in vain because God will prosper those things that he wants to prosper. And that's what you find out at the end of this chapter. They come back, all right? They keep the Passover on the 14th day of the month in Ezra chapter 6. In verse 20, the priests and the Levites had purified themselves. All of them were ritually clean, so they're following all the rules. They're doing the best that they can. It's not like Hezekiah's later on. They made their plans. They got it all done. But look at verse 21. Then the children of Israel, who had returned from the captivity, ate together with all who had separated themselves from the filth of the nations of the land in order to seek Yahweh, the God of Israel. See, isn't that interesting that this whole project was a witnessing effort? The whole thing was. And as people explained to the nations around that, look what our God's done for us. Look what he's done. Look what, you know, it was impossible. You thought it would never get finished. Look what he did for us. Then some of the Gentiles around them turned to the God of Israel. And that's why you'll see that happening. Now, it's a bit of a risk bringing in all those Gentiles because some of that was what causes the problem at the end of Ezra. But it's God's family. He's the one who's in control of it. He's the one that will take care of it. And we have to be willing to open those doors and bring in those other people and try to teach them the truth and help them understand and pray that God will open the eyes of their understanding. So they did all the things they were supposed to. They organized the temple service, right? They got the offerings going. The priests and the Levites were organized the way they were supposed to be. And they did all of that kind of stuff. And now the people are ready to go. They've got this temple built. And I can just imagine as the word finally made it up to Babylon, up to the Persian Empire, and Ezra is probably checking out all along, you know, how's it going? How's it going? And he finally hears it's finished. And I think you're going to see tomorrow that that's what Ezra does. Immediately he says, okay, let's go. It's time to get down there and work in that temple. And these people did rejoice. It was a great time of celebration. And that's the way it is here at Bible school too, isn't it? It's a great time to celebrate. But don't forget, it's God's work. We do our part, brethren and sisters, but it really is all about God's work and God's family. And so Paul would say to the Philippians that I'm sure that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. I'm sure he'll do it. God will do his part. In the end, if there's failure, it's going to be on us. It won't be on God. It will be us because he wants us in his kingdom. He wants us in his family. He wants us to be ready for the return of Christ. And he sent out his angels to do everything they can to convince us to make those good decisions to be ready for that day. So for this morning, let's make sure we pray that God will send our ecclesias motivated and energetic workers to stir up all of our ecclesias to good works. But pray for that. We all need it. We don't want to become an ecclesia that just becomes like, you know, stabilized to where, oh, we just do the same old thing, and it just sort of gets to be a drudgery over time. We need that enthusiasm of others to come in and say, hey, let's try this. Let's try that. And don't look for excuses to quit. Don't look around and say, well, you know, because the virus hit, I can just like stay home now, watch the meeting on TV with my pajamas on. And, you know, I don't even have to worry about who's sitting next to me anymore. And, I can just make sure I'm pure in my house and all those things that go through our minds about our comfort level. We've got to look to get involved. We want to be there. We want to help out. And even if you sit at home on a Bible class night and you say, well, I didn't get anything out of that. You ever thought of going to Bible class to talk to somebody and encourage them and help somebody else? See, it's not all about me. It's about what can you do to help other people. So don't look for excuses to quit when things go wrong because there's always going to be ecclesial problems. You know, and for those of us that do get discouraged, just look through the Bible. Right from the beginning to the end, there were ecclesial problems. There were never great ecclesias in the Bible. They always were full of problems because that's how God develops us. That's how he's training us to be part of his family. Are we going to get involved or are we just going to sit on the sidelines? So God will do the impossible. He really will. You think there's things that are impossible in your lives? You think that your children right now maybe don't love the truth and you think it's impossible that they'll ever come around? Don't ever give up. Never give up. You just don't know what God is going to do. He's just looking to see if we really want it and we pray for it and we trust that he'll do what we can't do. And don't forget to thank God for the angels. I really think if we are more aware of the angels' involvement in our lives, we'll see what's happening in the world in a different way and in our families and ecclesias. We'll be aware of the fact that when we have a conflict with another brother or a sister, we're not going to go up there and get angry at them and frustrate them because we'll realize, you know what? There are angels working with them too. We don't want to work against them. We want to work with them. We want to help people. We want to help the angels in their work. And so you find ways to join into that work. And this is how God trains us to join his family. It's a training program that he's got going on every day. So thank God for those angels who are constantly working in our lives. They're guiding our lives. Jesus Christ sends them out every day, and they will get the job done, brothers and sisters. And thank God for the fact that in his kindness and his mercy, he does do the impossible when none of us deserve it. None of us can ever earn it. He's doing this because he loves us. He wants us in his family. He cares about us. So why wouldn't he send his angels out to do whatever they can to help us make good decisions so that we can be ready when Jesus Christ returns?